Tantor Audio presents The Barrow by Mark Smiley. Narrated by Michael Page. Prologue. In the hills of the Manon Mole in the year 1471 IA. Somewhere in the dark, a woman whispered. As was in the nature of the upper reaches of the Manon Mole, the hillside did not provide a great deal of cover for the men trying to hide upon it. Dried chaparral, small gullies, and outcroppings of exposed and weathered stone. Further down in the lower hills, the trees and thickets would be larger, closer together. Not quite a wood, but easier for men and even horses to hide. But here, further up, where the wind was stronger, where the wind was weirder, the hillsides were not kind to those that did not wish to be seen. A set of sharp eyes would almost certainly have counted out 8 of them, spread out a bit along the slope, huddled by rocks and small brush, clustered in 2 small groups of 2, a group of 3, and a last lone figure bringing up the rear. Rough men, for they were all men save the woman in the rear, but she was dressed as a man, which in the Middle Kingdoms was essentially the same thing, not quite arrayed for ambush, but who nonetheless preferred that others did not spy them so quickly, and who made do as best they could with what skill they had and with the scant protections provided by the uncaring earth. But even sharp eyes might have missed the 3 men the furthest up the hill, almost 100 yards ahead of their fellows, firmly pressed against a hillock rise of grey-green moss and dark stone in the weird wind, and peering intently up the slope toward its summit. That summit bore a crown of upright stones, ancient menhirs marking a place of fey power, and a pathway of more menhirs, some of them fallen over or reduced to piles of rock, was visible up ahead of them. The man in the furthest lead didn't pay them attention. Instead, focusing his own sharp gaze on an outcropping of rock and stone just below the summit of the hill. From most angles, the outcropping would have seemed solid and unbroken. But from the vantage point the trio had chosen, the thin vertical maw of an opening could be seen, an entrance through the rock into the hill's side. The man in the lead studied the thin sliver of darkness in the rock for long minutes, not moving, pressed flatly against the side of a large block of mossy stone. He was dressed in a dark brown high-collared long coat of stiff leather, tight blue-black cloth breeches, and black leather boots, all splattered with mud and dirt. His clothes were finely crafted, and dull bronze buttons, corded trim, and faintly embossed patterns in the Atheri style on coat and breeches prevented them from being described as plain. But they were also worn and rough-used, the mark of a man who spent long days in travel. A point dagger and heavy-bladed falchion were strapped to his side by a broad black leather baldric, which doubled as an extra layer of protection across his chest. He had a spyglass in one of the satchels strapped to his body, but they were close enough to their intended destination that he did not need to use it. His sharp eyes would occasionally flicker left or right to scan along the hillsides and nearby ridgetops, or up to track a sparrowhawk wheeling in the distance against the clouds, only to return to stare at the door into the earth. He listened to the weird wind, hearing the faint jangling of small bells and the whisper of what could have been a song sung backwards. He sniffed the air and inhaled wet earth and old stone, moss and scrub thickets and tree heath, and from somewhere near the hint of something dead and rotting. The 2 men hidden in the rocks slightly behind and below the man in the lead did their best to imitate his stillness, but despite their patience and good sense, neither was a woodsman, either by training or by birthright. They did not see what he saw, or hear what he heard, or smell what he smelt. The closer of the 2 had blonde hair and fair skin, a golden youth of noble breed and bearing, though dressed down for the occasion. His fine travel coat and breeches were woven of good dark wool with silk trim, the sheen of the weave enough to tell that they were of quality. His sword brace held a dagger with a silver wire-wrapped pommel and a matching rapier. He was obviously charming and just as obviously trouble. He bore a faintly bemused expression on his face as he waited for the man in the lead to move, but his eyes were nervous. The third was older than his companions, perhaps almost 40 years of age, but improbably he was also quite handsome, despite the wear and tear. Chiseled, sunburnt features, a hint of mischief about the weathered mouth, cunning in clear blue eyes, rough stubble and dirty blonde hair dangling before his face, the air of surety and danger about him that came from being a veteran, though a veteran of what might have been less certain. He was dressed in a simple padded doublet of black cloth, opened to reveal an unbuttoned shirt and hairy chest, two long daggers strapped to his side, and a scabbarded broadsword and round metal shield slung over one shoulder, along with several leather packs and satchels. Vambrisses of dulled steel were strapped over each forearm. It was this third man who finally stirred and spoke.
"Blackheart," he grunted, "can we get on with it?"
He spoke low, but did not bother whispering. There was no one nearby to hear them. The man in the lead stared at the hillside ahead of them a moment longer, then turned and looked back. His name wasn't Blackheart. It was Stepan, son of Baron and Argant. But enough people had called him Blackheart over the years that it might as well have been his name. His features were distinctly Atheri, sun-kissed copper skin, short-cropped dark hair, high cheekbones, and a sharp, prominent nose with a diamond-shaped bump in it. Stubble darkened his chin and jaw. His left ear was pierced twice, as was common amongst some Atheri men, and set with small silver loops. He would almost certainly have been considered handsome, at least at first glance, until perhaps the eyes. His eyes were piercing, even unsettling to many, and his sharp gaze was tinged with a hint of hate, or perhaps simply disgust, as though whatever he was looking at had been judged and found wanting. And that gaze fell on the third man, and for a moment the third man regretted speaking. Stepan stared at him a second, then looked past him to take in the rest of their group, a hard-looking lot of grim-faced murderers and thieves spread out in the brush and rock below them, all dressed in dark travel clothes, haphazardly armed and lightly armored, with an occasional cuirass or ringed brigandine amongst them. They had been told to stick in pairs, but Stepan noted that one man had moved forward to join the group in front of him, leaving a slight figure alone in the rear. He squinted and frowned in annoyance, though as he was often frowning, it would perhaps be better to say that his frown deepened. But he was not surprised. That last figure in the rear made many men uncomfortable, though they could not perhaps put their fingers on why. He turned back to look up the hill.
"We're fucked," Stepan said, low and calm. "No cover between here and the entrance worth talking about. Not for our lot. The old fey stones might help a bit. Erim and I could maybe make it there without anyone seeing us, but not the rest of us, not in the day. So either we make a straight run for it and hope no one's watching, or we wait until dark."
"Shit," swore the third man, his sure expression wavering for a moment. "Shit," he repeated.
"It's all right, Guildford," said the second man. He glanced around at the nearby hills, the expanse of the range across the horizon, and made a short, subtle gesture with his hand. "We haven't seen anyone for half a day, not since that backwater village where we left the horses."
Guildford looked up at the second man.
"You've never been up here, Harvold. Stepan and me, we have," he hissed. "There's always someone watching up here. If it isn't one of the bandit knight descendants of the Wyvern King waiting to rob you blind, it's some of the fucking hill people waiting to cut your throat and cook you for dinner. Those same fucking villagers watching our horses are probably following us, waiting to do us in, if they're not busy chopping up our horses for their cooking pots."
Harvald's bemused smile grew wider in response.
"It's true I was not summoned to the campaign against the rebel Earl of Orliac, praise be to the heavens, so I defer to your combined experience of these hills, of course," he said. "But is it possible, given the disastrous outcome of said campaign, that you're just shitting your pants at the memory?"
"Fuck you, Harvold!"
hissed Guilford, suddenly angry enough to make most men take a step back.
"You weren't fucking there. Night battles, ambush and kidnappings, corpses strung up and flayed. The people of these hills do not fight fucking straight. They're vicious little shits worse than anything you've ever seen in the big city. And the rebel earl and his men are still out here somewhere, 1,000 fucking strong."
"No doubt," said Harvold, nodding sagely. "No doubt." Guilford was about to respond when Stepan glanced back.
"Shut it, both of you,"
Stepan said in a quiet voice that brooked no argument. Guilford was a marked man with a crew and certainly thought of himself as tougher than Stepan, but still he paused and nodded. Stepan turned back and contemplated the hillside ahead of them. His stern gaze swept over the ring of menhirs, nearby hillsides and brush-covered slopes, rocky crags and bleak summits, and in the distance the main high range of the Manon Mole, snow-capped against cloudy grey skies. It was a beautiful sight, he realized. Almost as beautiful as home. He listened to the weird wind for a little bit longer.
"Ah, fuck it," he said finally. "Let's go."
Somewhere in the dark, a woman whispered. They had come creeping to her in the dark, her children and her lovers, her nameless bringing word of brazen interlopers, cruel huntsmen from the cursed lowlands. 11 men, one of them fey-born and marked with wood magics, and another a servant of the Bright King walking in disguise. It was not the first time that men such as these had come, though the servant of the Bright King surprised her. Did he come as an emissary? Or as an enemy? So she had rolled her bones, for of bones she had plenty, and she had been filled with despair. Erim glanced about, mostly behind them back the way they had come, as was her job as the last in the line. She was supposed to be paired with Gap-Tooth Timms, but the moment they'd stopped, he'd slunk forward to hunker down with Porter and Smith behind some thorny bushes. She didn't mind. In truth, she was probably better off alone, so she could move quick and quiet and without having to worry about what Gap-Tooth thought of her. She counted off the others in the group ahead of her, looking at the backs of their heads. Gap-Tooth and Porter and Smith, then old John Passel and Hlu the Stew, then Colin of Loria and the tall, thin man everyone called the Stick. A mix of Orion and Danian commoners, united in their greed, amorality, and desperation. A hard lot, meant for hard things, and therefore perfect for the occasion. Up beyond them she could make out the three men way up in the front, three handsome men clinging to a hillside. Some might have considered themselves quite lucky to stumble into those three in a different place, say in a tavern or a revel or feast perhaps, except for the aura of danger that lurked about them and that hard gaze of hate in the lead. But that gaze might just quicken some pulses all the more. She wondered at the fact that the three best-looking men in the group were the ones in the lead. Was it just coincidence, she wondered? Or did men like that get together and plan it all out, the worldwide league of dashing rogues? Her mind wandered unbidden, staring up at the three of them, back to a story she'd heard being loudly told in a tavern back in Therapoli by three sailors just returned from the decadent cities of the Discedron coast. The sailors had been on a merchant cog that had stopped in Lagapoli, looking to trade for spices. Like all good sailors, they had visited its infamous temples to Diver, the Evening Star, and they regaled their eager audience with lurid stories of the priestess prostitutes there. A particularly beautiful one, a raven-haired temple dancer with bronze skin, dressed in nothing but golden chains, bracelets, and anklets, had invited them to experience a rare and special sacrament to her goddess, and there on the altars of the temple they had lain with her all at once. They claimed she'd cast some spell over them and anointed their cocks with a special oil so that they found themselves harder than usual, and that after furiously fucking her for what seemed an age, they'd spent themselves the first time only to find themselves still hard, and that they'd then switched places and rutted her again until they'd spent themselves a second time, and finding themselves still hard, had switched places yet again, so that by the end of it they'd each spilled their seed one time in each of her wet, eager orifices. The sailors had claimed the Descedrans even had a name for it, the Trephallus trepheri, and they'd claimed it was the most intense sex they'd ever had. Not everyone listening in the tavern had believed them. One old man said they'd been fooled by the priestesses there, who, he said, dosed their patrons with a potent of the poppy plant that made men have vivid waking dreams of impossible acts of pleasure. But she had believed them. She had been surprised to discover how very, very much she had wanted to believe them. She flushed at the memory of that story, and felt herself grow warm and wet between her legs, and she was briefly ashamed at being aroused while hiding behind a rock in the middle of some of the most dangerous country in the whole of the Middle Kingdoms. She took a deep breath and dug a nail into her wrist to give her mind something sharp to focus on. If she had been a different woman, she would have quickly offered a prayer to some god and a warding sign to drive off Ligrid, the queen of perversion, but in her case she knew that was of no use, and she just gritted her teeth at the pain. Erim looked up and saw the three men up in the lead rise. No more sneaking about, then. Guildford turned and signalled to his men to follow them up the hill. And they were indeed his men, the seven between him and her. If anyone had asked Gaptooth or the Stick, "Whose man are you?" they would have quickly answered, "I'm Guildford's man, Guildford of the Run Street in Vesslos." A meaningless answer in most quarters, as Guildford wasn't a noble or a knight, just a rough man that other rough men followed. But in other quarters it meant a great deal, as Guildford bore a brand from the Guild of Therapoli. Everyone knew that Stepan and Harvald were true king's men, with Harvald noble-born to boot, and so what their answer would be. But if someone had asked her, "Whose man are you?" she wasn't sure how she would answer. Not just because she wasn't a man, but because she didn't belong to anybody, and in most of the Middle Kingdoms that meant you were nobody. As the group started up the hill, she was glad to be moving again, stretching her long legs. She saw that a few of Guildford's crew mumbled curses and hobbled about, cramping after being immobile for so long, and she stifled a needless laugh. "No point in making this lot hate you even more," she chided herself. But as everyone started to get stretched out, they picked up speed, conscious now of moving up the hillside in the open for anyone to see. She moved quickly, her soft calf boots quiet against the mossy earth. She wore a black cloth doublet with dark bronze studs and brown leather cord trim, fitted tight against her boyish figure, and black flared breeches, puffed in the Eastern style. She was splattered with mud and dirt like everyone else. A pair of point daggers and a wire-hilt cut-and-thrust rapier hung at her side from a black leather baldric, the surface tooled with ornamental squares. Her dark hair was cut short and trim along the sides and back of her head by her ears, but then a bit longer on top and in front, so that wavy locks fell in front of her blue eyes. She wore a black silk neck scarf wrapped tight to hide the smoothness of her throat. Like several other members of Guildford's crew, she wore a metal codpiece that poked through a flap in her breeches. Not as large as had become the fashion in the Eastern Aurean lands of Dainfalia, where in imitation of their king, knights and courtiers wore steel metal codpieces sculpted into impressive, and in some cases very lifelike, erections. But her codpiece was of some size, nonetheless. As a woman, she would have been considered plain, perhaps even mannish. Her eyes were small, and her jaw too square. But as a man, oh yes, she made a very pretty and attractive young man in the eyes of most who saw her, even if in her case the codpiece turned out to be empty. Her breathing was hard but measured by the time the group reached the rocky outcroppings near the top of the summit. She looked up at the stone circle above them and slowed, watching Guildford's crew disappear into the earth one by one. The entrance into the earth looked to her like it must have been a natural fissure in the rock at some point, but the carved narrow arch, 8 feet in height, that became visible through the split in the rock was clearly made by men. She saw that Guildford's crew was about to leave her behind and sped up, sliding her rapier and one of her point daggers out of their sheaths as she did. She caught up with Gaptooth and Porter just as they slipped through the entrance, and she barely had time to think before she was through the arch into the darkness. It took a moment for her eyes to adjust. Gaptooth had a torch out in one hand and a heavy axe in the other, and that helped a bit, but not much. She could see several torches appearing and disappearing ahead of them as they moved through the earth. In the flickering torchlight she could see that they were in a narrow shaft that appeared to have been carved out of the rock itself, and she felt, more than saw, the packed earth under her boots. Behind her the entrance was a bright vertical crack in the dark. The wind whistled past the opening, making it sound like someone was whispering behind her, and she suppressed a quick shudder. The group was moving forward, and she followed. She saw the torches ahead of her lowering into darkness, and soon she was at the top of a narrow stone stair leading down into the earth. Gaptooth went ahead, and she had to be careful following, as his torch was right below her, and it sputtered and coughed smoke and embers into her face if she was too close behind. The stairwell was steep and narrow, and it almost felt like it was more like a ladder made of stone. If there had been defenders below, it would have been a tough fight. The ceiling of the stairwell was close enough that she could put her hand against it to help brace her way down. They hit the bottom of the stairs and found themselves in a small room, a landing of sorts. Arches were set in the four walls, one being the arch through which they had descended into the room, and the other three opening onto stone stairs leading downwards. Each arch was set with human skulls along its entire curved length, and each skull was marked on the forehead with an ugly black rune. She didn't know magic, not the way that Stepan and Harvald did, but she instinctively knew the runes were bad runes. Her left hand, holding the dagger, went to her chest, and she felt for the amulet tucked under her doublet with a couple of spare fingers, a bit of amber with an insect trapped inside it, set in a gold chain and enchanted. It had been a gift from Stepan, back when she'd first done a job with him. "To ward off black magic and the evil eye," he'd told her, and she'd believed him. She watched and listened as Stepan talked with Harvald and Gilford on the other side of the small and now very packed room. Everyone was crowded in on each other, trying to stay in the center, trying to stay away from the stairwell openings. "Too close," she thought. "No room to fight swords here, daggers only." "No, the spirits here are long gone," Stepan was saying as he consulted a map in his hands. "The account we found in the archives said that during the Wars of the Throne Thief, an expedition mounted out of Truz had come here, and that a company of priests and magisters led by none other than the Knight Sir Olsig had worked a great ritual and driven all the trapped guardian spirits out." "The ghost killer himself. Trust us, if there were still ghost wardens present here, we'd already be in big trouble by now," said Harvald. He looked around at the arches, eyeing the skulls that decorated the arches with a kind of wary nonchalance. "Can you imagine the struggle to purify this place? All these skulls..." Gilford shuddered.
"Who were they, do you think?" he asked. "Victims of the nameless cults, or adherents letting themselves be bound here as guardians?"
"Doesn't really matter," said Harvald with a shrug. "The end result is the same." Stepan moved in front of the archway to the left of the one they had entered from, and slipped the folded map back into his stiff square satchel. He pulled out a piece of chalk and marked the side of the arch with an arrow pointing down. "This one, according to the map in the archives," he said to the group. "I'll go first. Follow the downward arrows, then reverse them if you have to get out." He gave them all a wry half-grin, and Erim watched as he took a torch and started down the narrow, steep staircase. Her whispers grew more urgent now. Once long ago this had been a place of great power, until the bookmen had come from their tower on the plain of stones and rendered this sacred place silent with violence and the curses of their false divine king. Long years it had taken the faithful to restore the temples and shrines, and her chest swelled with pride to think of what had been accomplished. But with that pride came despair as well. If only she'd had a few more years, or had known how to bind the guardian ghosts. The nameless at Dyer Callum had promised to teach her the ritual, but always they delayed and raised the price, and now it was too late. And so she whispered what she knew and called for his help. Downward they'd gone, hitting on three landing rooms like the first one above them, and on each landing Stepan had picked out and marked an archway down. After the first one on the left, he picked out three on the right. Some of the landings had other stairs going up, rather than just the one they entered through. Erim started to have an inkling that the whole hill must have been honeycombed with stairs and rooms going up and down. By the fourth landing, she could feel the weight of the earth around and above them, all those narrow steps winding back up through the dark, and she could feel the panic starting to eat in the back of her throat. The air here was totally still, dead. She could see it in the wide eyes and sweating brows of the other men as well. The descent had started to take its toll on them.
206, she heard old John Passel whisper.
What?
Hissed Porter.
206 steps so far,
old John whispered back.
I counted them.
I was counting too, said Hlu the Stew. Thought it was 204 myself, but close enough.
Fuck me, someone moaned, but she couldn't tell who it was.
Erim had never been good with numbers bigger than she could count on fingers and toes. Thus, 10 times 10 she could handle up to 100. So the idea of being 206 steps below the earth was only slightly more scary than the idea of counting that high. Men who knew the law of numbers, like Stepan and Harvald, and could count and do additions in their heads, always impressed her. But then Stepan and Harvald were practically magicians. Hlu the Stew used to be a steward, hence his name, so it made sense that he could do numbers, but she was a bit surprised that old John Passel could count in his head like that. Then again, he probably didn't become old John Passel without learning a few tricks. She wished she'd been smart enough to even think of counting the steps, though she wasn't sure what good it did them. Luckily, this landing seemed different than the others. Instead of opening onto more staircases up and down, the archways opened onto straight level passages lined with stone slabs. Stepan picked one, marked it, and slipped through it, followed quickly by the rest of them. Erim found herself last again, though being rearguard had now taken on a different tenor. Behind her stretched the inky blackness of empty tunnels and stairs up and down through the earth, and the darkness was starting to fill her with fear. She hurried to keep up with Gaptooth and his sputtering torch as their short column moved through into a wider antechamber, with pillars carved out of rock and black arches opening into who knew what, and then a turn and out into a short passageway again. She was starting to get worried that if she panicked she wouldn't know how to get out, that she'd forget to look for the markings and take a wrong turn, or if the torches all went out, how would they even see the chalk marks? Suddenly they slowed, and she almost ran right into Gaptooth's back. She wasn't sure what was happening ahead, but the entire group was moving with caution, backs crouched, weapons and shields up. Instinctively she did the same, adopting a fighting crouch, dagger and rapier ready, sidestepping her way forward. The moment she did, she found herself calming, the familiar pose triggering a steady breath.
Ah, right, that's what training's for, she thought to herself.
It was an odd feeling, fear and excitement coursing through her, preparing her body for a fight or for flight. And yet at the same time, the calm of her training settling in, centering her, making her feel safe and certain.
I know what to do, she thought. I'll just kill whatever comes in front of me.
And then she was moving in behind Gaptooth into a large underground chamber, and she straightened and let out a long, slow breath of relief and wonder as she walked forward. The torchlight from the others spread out with them throughout the room, lighting its high walls and ceiling with flickering hues of red and black and orange, and illuminating other archways opening out in its walls to other dark chambers.
Several great columns flanked the central aisle of the chamber, carved with obscene images and strange barbaric letters that she couldn't read, and there were frescoes of some kind.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?